the National Archives podcast series, Lessons from Workshops about Licensing and Releasing Data, presented by Owen Stevens.
Okay, thank you very much. My name's Owen Stevens, and I do work in the area mainly of libraries. My background is as a librarian and as an IT specialist in universities, and I now do work in that area. And I was asked to talk today about the licensing of resources and data and to share experiences that I've brought together through working on a specific project in the UK HE sector. So that's where I'm starting from. I'll say a bit more about that project in a minute. A lot of the time when we talk about making data available, I think in that talk Leanne mentioned several times, she talked about LODLAM, which is linked open data in libraries, archives and museums. And it's often when we talk about making data available that there's a movement towards open data. I might use that term today, but I'll try and be a bit more specific. One of the things about talking about open data, and people will say, you know, exhort you to open up your data, make it available, is that that's not really a black and white thing. It's not a binary choice that stuff is either open or closed. It's a spectrum or a continuum, and I want to consider that today. The project I worked on was called Discovery, which is rather confusing, especially standing here in the National Archives and having a talk. Some of you will be aware of the National Archives Discovery platform, which Alex talked about this morning. It's nothing to do with that, so the danger of adopting common words to name your projects. This came out of a group set up by JISC, who funded the project. They fund work in higher education, especially in the library and archive, library and IT space, but also encompassing archives and museums in that space as well. And the Research Libraries UK group, as well as several national libraries and national services contributing to that group, which was called, snappily, the Resource Discovery Task Force. And they were asked to look at how, for researchers in the higher education space in the UK, we could make things more discoverable. And this resulted in a vision document, which I've summarised here as saying it was about trying to establish a clear set of principles and practices for the publication and aggregation of open and reusable metadata. And as I say, that suggests kind of an open is well-defined, which is not. But that project was really, first stage of that project focused very much on how do we make data available from all the institutions that hold it. So cultural heritage institutions such as archives, museums, libraries, how they hold this data, often in catalogues or in some form within the organisation. How, what are we saying about making that available so it can be aggregated, and whether that aggregation is done by specialist organisations like the Archive Hub or generalists like Google. For the Discovery projects, it was all about publishing that data openly, whatever that meant, and enabling aggregations, enabling other people to bring that data together and make it usable, make it useful, make it discoverable. So this issue of open, I think one of the things that that statement suggests is that you want to go all the way, you want to make everything open. And the way that I have started to think about it as I've worked on this project, and I was part of that original group, so I had to take responsibility for the way we framed that vision, is that it's kind of about friction. It's about how much friction is there in people making use of your of stuff you publish, stuff you have, and especially in this case about using the data you're publishing to enable discovery, so finding aids, catalogues, whatever that is, as well as actual content if you've got digital objects on the web, etc. And friction can be good. Friction isn't, you know, it's about friction, but friction can be good. So the banana skin, you know, this is a typical example of friction, lack of friction being a bad thing. So friction is not an innately bad thing, and frictionless use of data can mean losing control, and that's something that can raise a lot of concerns about that, you know, what's going to happen if we do this, and losing control can be okay, but it can be a worry. So today what I'm going to be talking about is one specific aspect of this, which is licensing, the licensing of data, licensing of content. But overall, that you have to bear in mind other aspects. That's just one aspect of things that make your content reusable. So if you haven't published it on the web, it doesn't matter what license you put on it. If it's on a computer sitting in your bedroom, then that's not accessible no matter how well you've licensed it. So discovering accessibility of data are other aspects of this. And to some extent, the interesting, those of you who were in the session this morning from Alex talked about the National Archive Discovery platform, is that that's more about the question about making this accessible and usable. He didn't talk about the licensing, so hopefully the talk that I'm going to give now is complements that. So one of the things that, if you want people to make use of the stuff you put on the web, one of the things that can create that friction, that question about do people reuse it, is, well, I would say it's two ways. One is explicit restrictions, things that you've said, you know, so this is copyright us, you can't do stuff with it. That's one kind of thing that creates friction. The other, which I think is much more common actually, in for a lot of the data that we hold as cultural heritage organisations, is uncertainty about possible restrictions. So not saying anything about the nature of the thing you're publishing, or how you expect it, or how it might be reused. So those are the two things that I hope, you know, I can talk about a bit today, which is what those explicit restrictions might be, and why is it important to say something, even if what you're saying is you can't use this, or you can only use it in a very specific way. That's better than not saying anything at all. And I think that what I'd encourage you to do is think about all of your data in this context, not just the obvious stuff. So if you've got a digitized photograph that you're publishing on the web, you've probably thought quite hard about whether you're allowed to do that and what the rights are. But if you publish a description of that photograph next to it, do you say anything about how that data might be used? Is the description of the photograph subject to the same terms and conditions as the photograph itself? And often it won't be, but you may not say anything about that on your website. You're very highly likely to say something about reuse or copyright on digital objects, but less likely to say things about their descriptions. So the first thing is, why explicitly license? And I think that this is about enabling appropriate reuse or use of your stuff by others, and to some extent to discourage inappropriate use. And that's kind of appropriate and inappropriate, that's down to you to define. You it's your stuff, and there aren't hard and fast rules about what's appropriate and inappropriate, although there may be legal restrictions in some cases. So you may not own all the stuff you're publishing on behalf of other people. You may have specific agreements around it that you've come to with the content owner, the IP owner, copyright owner, and that's fine. But what you're really doing by applying a license, that is making an explicit statement about what can be done with the stuff, is that you're saying you don't have to ask to make this kind of use. So if I put up some stuff, some text on the web, if I publish a blog, that's copyright me, right? There's no question about that. If I've written the stuff and I publish it, I retain some kind of copyright over the stuff that I publish. So that means that you can't just take that and reuse it without asking me. And I might say, that's fine, no problem. I'm really happy for you to reuse any of that text, but you can't just do it, or you can't just do it willy-nilly. There are restrictions on it. If I say, I'm happy for you to take it, if I say it up front, you don't have to ask me. So that's what we're doing when we say, when we license stuff, we're making that explicit. We're saying, you don't have to ask to make this kind of use. This is the kind of use that I don't need you to ask me about. You just go ahead and do it. And you have to think about what you're enabling and what you're preventing. And I think the important question here with licensing, and I think that a lot of the licensing discussions often, for me, leap into what kind of license should we have? You know, and I'll talk about the different kinds of license, but if anybody's been involved in what kind of license should we have? And I think the first question is, what is it you want to achieve? So rather than starting with the licensing, think about what you want to achieve. If you have digital collections, what is it you want to achieve by it? You know, what you might want to achieve is maximising traffic to those digital collections, so that you can point at a Google Analytics page and say, look, lots of people use our stuff. Or it might be that you want to make your stuff just more widely known, or it might be that you want to encourage people through the door of your institution. So think about what you're trying to achieve. If you want to, in that scenario, if you have digital collections, you want to maximise traffic to them, that probably means being promiscuous with your descriptions of them. So getting your descriptions out as widely as possible will encourage people to come and look at your stuff, right? Because they'll know you've got it. Whereas if you don't tell people about your stuff, then they can't come and see you. So it's also worth thinking about, people may be making use of your material every day without asking permission. And some of that will be okay on the copyright. You might have copyright material. People will use that under certain terms and conditions. They're allowed to, under certain conditions, they're allowed to make use of that without asking the copyright owner. That's okay. They can put fair use defence. The copyright owner could take them to court and say, no, this wasn't fair use. You published it in a book and that wasn't okay. But generally, there are reasonably accepted uses of copyright material. So you don't have to ask for everything. But much of this may be unclear. For instance, Google, if you have a web page, Google will be crawling that and indexing it, making a cached copy, and using that to generate business, right, for Google. And it's very unclear whether that's okay, because they haven't asked your permission, right? So they, you know, back to my blog example, they send out software which copies my blog, puts it into their index, they use it, and we kind of all accept that. Nobody thinks about it, really. And Google's line on it, and this came up especially with newspapers, because some of the newspapers got a bit upset with the way that Google was, they felt, stealing their traffic. People would go to Google, do the search, see the headline, never visit the page, right? So newspapers got a bit upset about this. And Google's line on it was, there's a really well-known mechanism for saying to our software, don't copy text from my site. It's called robots.txt file, which I'm not going to talk about today. But it's really, Google say, that's a really well-known thing to do. If you want to opt out of Google, you can just fill that file out on your website and we won't touch your stuff. And that's the way that, you know, so it's kind of an opt-out rather than opt-in. And they've said that's their defence, if you like. However, it's notable that when Google tried the same kind of treatment of non-digital items, especially books, they hit problems. So they were saying, we're digitising the books, but this is just like making a copy of your web page. All we want to do is index it. We don't want to give the book away. We just want to index it and make it searchable. And display a little bit about it, but we're not, you know, we've got copies, yeah, but we're not using that to give to people. So that's okay. And they found that authors and publishers didn't necessarily agree with them on that and were organised enough to take them to court about it. Still ongoing in terms of the outcome. So why are we licensing? That use by people like Google or like others, I think that use is going to happen anyway. So it doesn't matter what you license your stuff as, Google will crawl it and do whatever Google does, unless you explicitly stop them. They don't care about the agreements, they don't care about the licensing, they care about that one file and that's it. So that's going to happen anyway. When you think about licensing, you should probably think about the people who want to do the right thing, who want to do what you tell them is okay, not about the people who are going to abuse your collections. Because the people who abuse your collections are going to abuse, you know, your rights anyway. They're not responsible citizens who will think, oh no, they have put a license on this, I won't do it. You want to make sure that you're not blocking the people who are your friends who want to do the right thing by making conditions which are your kind of worst case scenario of the worst possible abuses by some malevolent person. What are we talking about licensing? This is a problematic area, I think, especially talking in the archive space, in the museum space. Library space is slightly simpler, but because we're talking about several different kinds of things. And the first and most obvious one I've mentioned is content. So digital objects, digital pictures, video, whatever it is, that they will be generally covered by some kind of copyright or IP regime already. And as long as that's creative, it's been a creative work in some way, that's something you need to think about licensing. Facts are kind of a bit outside that, but even, you know, layout of facts is copyright. So you've got that kind of content. You've also got data about your content. So this is your descriptive, your metadata, your finding aids, etc., your catalogue. And that's usually kept in a database. And there are several rights that apply to this kind of stuff. So when you think about licensing, don't just think about what you might regard as your crown jewels, the real content, but also think about the other stuff that you're putting alongside the content. And in terms of what you have to think about licensing is that you have creative works, which are generally covered by copyright. You also have the metadata, which may be a mixture of creative and factual data. So some of your metadata will be quite factual, and that may not be subject to copyright. It's not always entirely clear, it has to be said. Most of the time, court cases are the only way of deciding whether it's protected or not. But there will be other parts of your metadata which have taken more significant intellectual effort and would probably be regarded as creative. And it should be said that even something like a newspaper headline can be regarded as creative. So it can be quite short. It doesn't have to be a long amount. As long as it's taking some intellectual, creative effort, then it will be something that you should think about licensing. You can't just assume people can use that, that's okay. And then finally, you have collections of things, and that's what we might regard as a database. So often your catalogue of things that you might publish, that's a database of stuff. So even if all of the data in that is not covered by copyright, if that was just a list of, I don't know, a database of boiling points of well-known elements, right? That wouldn't be copyright because that's factual, right? You couldn't copyright the facts. But the database itself, that collection of facts, in the UK and in Europe, may well be protected by what's called the database or the sui generis database right. So that was brought in by the European Union, intended to protect collections of stuff, as long as you put a lot of effort into collecting it. So if it wasn't trivial. And I think that that would describe most archival collections. If you've described it, if you've created a database of descriptions, then that's covered probably by that. Well, it certainly would come under the remit of that rule. It has to be said that the two major court cases on this, which have not been in archives, they've been about football fixtures and racing fixtures, have suggested that that database right isn't a very strong one, actually. The database right is not very... you have to really show some significant original effort in building that set of data, as opposed to just having the data that you put in a database. So this was the issue with, say, horse racing fixtures. The people who made the data actually were the people who set up the racing fixtures. So they weren't seen as creating the data, they were seen as creating the fixtures, and therefore the data wasn't protected. It's one of these legal arguments. I think that you might apply the same to, say, a publisher. They create books or items, and they then have to describe them. But the data is created as a side effect of that production process, probably. For archives, libraries, museums, I think most of the time we're investing in that descriptive act as for itself, not as a side effect of some other activity. And so it's more likely to be protected. So database rights may apply to database things, and therefore you have to give consideration about, do you want to license a database of content? Do you want to say something about the usability of the whole collection of stuff, as opposed to individual bits from the thing? Does that make sense? And databases can also be protected by copyright, because they can be creative works in themselves. But that doesn't usually cover their content. It usually covers things like creativity in terms of structure or data formats, rather than actual content, which may, as I said before, may be protected by copyright or other rights itself. So when we talk about licensing, what are we doing? Well, the two major licensing regimes actually build on top of copyright and the database right. So you have to have those to be able to license your stuff. You can't assert licenses for reuse of materials unless you have some kind of right to do so. And the two major ones were, in this area, a scheme called Creative Commons. Has everybody heard of Creative Commons? Yeah, a lot of nodding there. And Open Data Commons. Has everybody heard of Open Data Commons? A lot less nodding there, which is what I expect. Creative Commons is by far the most widely used. The thing about Creative Commons is that it is based on copyright, solely on copyright. And that means that that database right I just talked about is not covered by a Creative Commons license, which is something you have to be aware of when you think about licensing a whole collection as opposed to an individual thing within your collection or an individual bit of data within your database. So these are the things that Creative Commons enables. These are the flavours, if you like. They have a zero, which is essentially saying, as far as possible, under the rights I have and the legal framework I work within, I'm making this in the public domain. Anybody can use it for any purpose. You can do whatever you like with it. You've got buy, which means you have to attribute if you use it. You've got share alike, which means you can use it, but you have to use it under the same conditions that I'm making it available to you. So you have to make it available what you do under the same conditions that I'm making this data available to you. Non-commercial means that it can't be used for commercial purposes. And no derivatives means that you can't make additional materials. You have to take the material as it is. You can't make something new from the material you've been given. So if you give me a picture, I can't then make that into a montage of pictures. I can use the picture as a non-derivative, but not. And the problem with several of these, especially in the bottom two, non-commercial and non-derivative, is they're very, very grey. Non-commercial, for instance, if I stand up and talk to you today, I'm a business and I use images. Is that commercial use or not? I'm not getting paid for today, but I am, a commercial entity. If I run a picture on my blog and I run adverts against it, is that commercial use? And I think that often the thing that I find with this is that I think people put non-commercial on because they want to stop large-scale use, not that small-scale use, generally, And it's a pain that that's a very undiscriminatory term, and it's a pain that it's actually very unclear what commercial use means. So if you do put on non-commercial use, you may want to consider clarifying what you mean by commercial use, or at least some level of clarification. Wired issue pictures, Wired is a magazine, Wired issue pictures on the website under a non-commercial Creative Commons license, but they also add some additional data about what they mean by commercial usage. So they try to be a bit clearer than the licenses itself on that point. Attribution is also a very common one. People want people to say I used your, you know, I used something from your collection. That's obviously really important to institutions like archives, where you want to see some kind of benefit. You want people to know that that came from your archive. That's part of the point, right, of having your stuff out there. People know it came from you. The problem with attribution is that it's really easy on single use and very difficult when you're bringing together sources from 1,000 places. So if I build a database that aggregates 1,000 archives, having attribution statements for all of them is much more difficult than if I just use one of your pictures. So that's one of the considerations there about attribution. They actually don't combine kind of freely. This is a list, the whole list of the Creative Commons flavors, but I'm not going to say much more about those. I think I've talked about them enough. The other one I want to just mention is Open Data Commons, much less well known, based on not just copyright but the database right as well, and that's why it's important for data collections. They have a much simpler model, three flavors. Public Domain Dedication License, that's essentially equivalent to a CC0. CC0 is the one Creative Commons license that can be used safely with databases because it gives away all rights, no matter what they are, whereas all the others don't apply to databases. PDDL and CC0 are essentially equivalent. They do the same thing. Open Data Commons Attribution, same kind of idea, but covering that database right. And Open Database License is Attribution Share Alike, again. One other license I wanted to mention is the Open Government License, because it's specifically used by the TNA. It's slightly different, but it requires attribution. It allows commercial use and derivatives. So it's in the area of a buy license, a buy type license. I wanted to just cover a couple of examples in the last few minutes. This is one that I think is really notable because it's a high profile one, and it's also making a decision not just about kind of descriptive data, which I've talked about, but an image, where the Rijks Museum originally applied a attribution license to the images and then decided to make it CC0, to essentially put it in the public domain. And the reason they did that was they saw so many inaccurate copies, they wanted their copy to be used more widely. They had a real they had people complaining that the postcards were not of the picture because the image in people's minds was different to the actual picture, and they wanted to counterbalance that. And so they felt, you know, obviously there would be consideration there about would this reduce their revenue on selling images, selling postcards, for instance. But they felt there were so many abuses of it out there already. They had nothing to lose and everything to gain by making theirs the image that people could use. And so they went for a much more permissive license. Some other examples from the archives world, and there are lots of examples in the library world as well. The Archives Hub have done a linked data project, and that's licensed under CC0. One of the reasons for that is that attribution issue. When you do linked data, you tend to be combining data from lots of sources, and that's where you get into this trouble with attribution. You have lots and lots of individual statements. So one archive might make a statement about the date of birth, another archive might make a statement about where they lived on a certain date. Two different very granular statements, each having to be attributed. And even a single record could contain, you know, 10 attribution statements if you want to attribute at that level. That was one of the reasons, I think. James from the Archives is sitting here in the front row, because he can contradict me on that. The University of Sussex Mass Observation Archive went for a PDDL license, which is equivalent. The Wellcome Trust do a whole range, depending. And I think this is what I, you know, the thing I would highlight about subtlety of approach. Think about each bit of thing. Don't just decide you're doing one license. You know, they do everything from CC BY to CC BY NA, and they, you know, would say they would consider each kind of data on a case-by-case basis. Manufacturing Pasts is a digital archive project at the University of Leicester, and they went for CC BY NC for content, so non-commercial attribution of content, which is a lot of digital pictures, audio, visual stuff. But they went for CC0 for metadata, and I talked to them about this, and they said that they absolutely wanted to be used by everybody, so they're pushing it into Culture Greer, they're pushing it into Google, they're pushing it into Archives Hub, they're pushing it into a media hub, and they want everybody to use the metadata because they want people to know that they have the collection, and then they want the click-throughs to their copy. So they don't want a lot of people using the actual content, so they're restrictive about that, but they want a lot of people to know about it, so they're very permissive on that. And there are, if you're interested, there's a URL there which has case studies of each of these organisations and more. I'll just mention one more, which is the British Library, which is another interesting case study where they went from a quite restrictive licence to a CC0 licence. So they went from very restrictive, actually, to very permissive. And this was data that they sold initially, so they've also got a revenue stream alongside it. And a couple of interesting points to pick up from that was they make it available under a public domain licence in a completely different format to the one they sell it in. And so they believe it's a non-trivial process to go between the two formats. So they still think they get the revenue stream from the stuff they're selling to specific customers, as well as making this stuff publicly available. The other reason they adopted a CC0 was they wanted to distance themselves from any abuse of the data. So if one of the worries that people often, and I talked to the University of Sussex, and when they did a kind of risk exercise, and I recommend this as an approach, think about the risk you're exposing yourself to when you decide on a license. And they came up with worst case scenarios, and their worst case scenario was some far-right neo-fascist organisation using stuff from the mass observation archive to somehow justify a point, right? And that was their worst case scenario, bad publicity for them, bad publicity. And the British Library decided that CC0 was the best way of separating out them as the originators of the data from any use of it, because they felt, if we say this is just public domain rather than you can use it under licence with our permission, then they suddenly became separate. And that was a discussion with their legal team, that they would separate themselves from responsibility for how that data might be used externally. I thought that was a very interesting point, not one that I'd come across before, but I think it's quite a strong argument for saying, you know, you may not, you get both sides of the agreement if you're quite restrictive. You're exerting control, and that can be a good thing, you may need to, but it can be a bad thing, because if people then act within your license, you may be seen as more responsible. Thank you very much for listening today. I'll be back here happy to answer questions now or in the coffee break.
Talk was recorded on the 7th of March 2013 at the National Archives, Kew. This podcast is copyright to the National Archives. All rights reserved.